break out your wireframes and heat up those Git repos. We're ready to tackle topics ranging from accessibility to front-end design, user experience, and beyond. You're listening to the Drunken UX Podcast with your hosts, Michael Feenan and Aaron Hill. This is episode number 75. I messed up last week, or last episode. I said it was 73 when it was actually 74, because we now have enough shows that I can't even keep them straight in my show notes. I would actually probably blame it more on me moving topics around from week to week, but no, I was just dumb. That was all your mouth too. This is episode number 75. We're going to be talking about going back to basics with flaws and fundamentals. I had some fun with alliteration in the title of this because I literally have no other gimmicks in my back pocket. We're going to be talking about stuff that people do wrong and no, only my back pocket. Only my back pocket.
Did you check your front pocket?
Who carries change anymore?
You should look in your front pocket. There might be change there.
I use my watch. I got the little the NFC, you know. Mm-hmm. Don't have to touch nothing. No COVID. No COVID for Michael. I don't touch nothing. I just boop, boop.
Oh, nice. That's really cool.
If you are enjoying the Drunken UX podcast, be sure to check out our sponsors over at NewCloud. You can find them at newcloud.com/drunkenux if you need any interactive mapping software or campus illustrations, map illustrations. Run by, drop in and see what they have to offer.
You guys should come check us out at Twitter and Instagrams.com/drunkenux. Actually, Twitter and Facebook.com/drunkenux, but also instagiggles.com/drunkenuxpodcast. And at drunkenux.com/discord, come talk with us. Tell us what you think. Tell Michael where the change is.
Okay, Aaron, I'm changing my pace up significantly this week. I've said many times I'm not a beer guy, but I'm drinking a Boulevard Jam Band.
Show me the label on that.
I picked up a six-pack of this. It's a berry ale.
Huh.
Comes in at 5.9%. It's not bad. Oh,
that's pretty strong.
I found a couple beers recently that I don't hate. My friendly local neighborhood bar has what I lovingly refer to as the 90s beer. Because I don't know what its name is.
Yeah.
All I know is the tap handle looks like, you know, something from 1992. It's like neon and has like the crisscrossy graphic lines and stuff. Oh, so I just call it the 90s great beer. I like it. It's pretty good. And then this, I think I had this once before and I saw it at the store and I'm like, I remember that. And so I got a six pack of it. And so I'm having that tonight.
I've got a bourbon and Coke. It's a Four Roses bourbon. It's basic. I've drank a lot of bourbon this week.
Oh, good for you. It's nice to see you growing up. I mean, we need to put a little more hair on your chest and on your face, so.
This is the most facial hair I've ever had. I know that it's not nearly as much of a beard as your beard, but the quarantine has made me very furry.
You can match the regalia of my facial fur.
That's like if ZZ Top was trying to be modest.
I tell my sixth graders that I'm just Santa Claus in training. Do sixth graders still believe in Santa Claus? I genuinely don't know.
Some might.
Okay. What we're going to be talking about is this idea of how do people, you know, approach or what, let's say not how do people, but what mistakes do developers make early on that they may not realize they're making? You know, what flaws are there in the code that need to be avoided?
Can I tell the story of how this topic came about?
I mean, you're well, this is, as far as I'm concerned, you're driving this show.
All right. So I was checking my, as many people are doing in the month of November, it's open enrollment for my company for benefits. And so I was instructed to go to our benefits website and, you know, sign in and then make my benefit selections. And this site was just a nightmare because they made everything be mediated through JavaScript. And like, we have all these behaviors that we get for free. Like, if you have a button on a form and you click the button, the browser will implicitly serialize the form data and send it to the target of the form. If you have a link you can put a URL on the link as an href property, and if someone clicks on it, it will do a link thing. It'll take you to the place. There's all these like behaviors that we get automatically, and then I don't know why, but people feel the need to like recreate or redefine all these behaviors, and it's just nuts. But the UX of this site was just terrible. I kept having problems with like I'd click on a button and the JavaScript would fail, and I couldn't do anything. Like everything was mediated through the JavaScript. So when there were problems, like I could do nothing about it.
I didn't talk to you about this before, but I don't think I knew that this was an HR portal that you were using. You just talked about the link activity and stuff therein. I just did the same thing because it is November now. Our HR portal for benefits doesn't work in Firefox.
Wait, why?
I don't know. It literally does not work. It will not let you in with Firefox.
Oh my god.
And yeah, that's kind of one of those same sort of things. Like, it just makes me think, what are you doing inside of this that is so weird and proprietary that it doesn't work in Firefox? That's bizarre.
That is so strange.
So we want to help you not fall into those traps in this episode. This is all about that stuff. So if you are a super experienced dev, listen up, and you may learn something that you didn't think about, or maybe you've been doing for a while. We have, I'm sure Aaron, you've got your things. There are things I do that I know are not the best approach to stuff, but you know, sometimes you need to sit down and hear other people talk about it. And so we're going to try to help a little bit on that. I want to start with markup. Yeah. Markup's an easy one. And I think actually, I didn't write it here on the show notes, but I think one of the simplest things to do vis-a-vis markup is just learn it. Yeah. Learn markup. It doesn't take long. It's not hard. Like, you're talking a day. In a day, you can know HTML markup inside and out for the most part. But you need to take the time to learn it. And I learned, and I think, Aaron, you have plenty to say on this topic, I think. You know, we learned by doing a lot.
Yeah.
In the 90s and early 2000s, you know, we learned a lot by looking at other people's code and copying and figuring out. And so we learned by doing on a lot of that stuff. But you don't have to do that now. Like, you can just learn by learning.
Yeah, yeah. Like, there's plenty of courses out there for this stuff and lots of tutorial resources. I think another thing behind this episode is something that I've noticed. So I've been doing this professionally for like 16 years now. And but I was learning HTML in the mid 90s. I was doing it as an amateur. Yeah. And I know that you were similar, right?
Yeah, like 96. First website, 1996.
Yeah. I think mine was around then. I forget exactly when it was.
Built it on the library computer because I didn't have internet at home.
Awesome. When you and I were starting, we were doing this stuff, and like, we kind of learned things as the technology grew. And so, like, our knowledge grew with the technology with a fair amount of parity. Like, I don't think at any point we knew everything, but in the body of knowledge that was possible, at least I felt like this, and from talking to you, I think you did too, that we had a decent grasp of what was possible and how to do most things. I don't think that's the case anymore with the, like, the junior devs entering the workforce. And I don't mean this as a slight on them at all. It's a circumstantial issue. Like, they're with boot camps, which are great resources and a great way to get to fast track your way into a job that can be very lucrative. You're learning enough to be like functional in a workplace in a very short amount of time, and you can get a job and you can do the job, but you're missing out on like some of the things that we've had the luxury of learning because we had a lot longer of like time to learn it. We've had more time and more experience.
You don't pick up a lot of the theory sometimes, you know.
Yeah,
it gets to be kind of a monkey see, monkey do, which is one thing that I really struggle with myself. Is I hate tutorials that show me code to do something, but then doesn't say why they're doing it certain ways. Because for me, I like learning, well, why did you use a for loop instead of a spread operator or something like that? Right. Like, there's choices that are made. And we're going to talk about some of those choices here in a few.
You and I both started doing HTML, and we've done HTML forever, and we've earned it initially, which is like what people are learning now with boot camps and other, you know, getting started things. But then after learning initially, we've learned how to do it semantically, and we learned, like, you know, the correct ways to use tags. And I think there's a lot of people entering the workforce right now that haven't had that experience yet. And I think it's important for us as, like, kind of the old guard. I don't know if that's the right phrase or not, but
no, we're old guard. That's
old
fair.
Guard. Okay.
Yeah. I have white in my beard. A lot of white in my beard.
It's you look old, like I'm an old guard person.
I am old guard.
So us as the old guard, like, I feel like we have a responsibility to share this with the new people coming in and to show them, you know, that all the things that, like, this ancient technology that exists already. I love you, juniors. You're great. And I just, there's a lot of stuff for you to learn. And we older, like, seasoned developers want to share it with you. And here's some of it.
Here's some of it.
So that's kind of, yeah.
So the first one on my list is using header tags to control presentation.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
So you know how an H1 is bigger than an H6?
Yes.
One thing that I see a lot of are people using H tags because they want big font.
Got it.
So, that's H1's too big. So let's just make it an H3. Oh, yeah, that's about right. We'll leave that with no regard for the fact that H tags, to use your phrase, they have semantic meaning.
Exactly.
They affect the outline of the page, which for most people isn't a big deal, but is a big deal to search engines and is a big deal to anybody using a screen reader.
Yeah, the accessibility aspect is really, really important.
Yeah, a lot of this will come back. I mean, accessibility is usability, is mm-hmm. doing things right. I mean, this is a life cycle, circle of life, whatever you want to call it, type of thing, you know? So a lot of this will factor into that. But yeah, that's, you know, it's a simple thing, and I see it a lot, not even with developers, but with content managers. You know, you'll mm-hmm. get people who don't understand HTML. All they know is if I select H2, it's bigger than H3, so that's what I want.
Right.
And they don't think about it from an outline kind of standpoint. But H tags are meant to develop an outline. If you need an H2 to be small, style it small.
I've seen places where there are classes, H1 through H6, and you use the headings as they're meant to be used, and then you just pick the class that you want to use for size.
Yeah.
Which, like, I mean, it's technically not wrong, but, like, it feels like, huh?
Well, and here's what I'll say. We do that. We've got in our pattern library use cases for that, because there are places where, for instance, let's say a normal H2 is mm-hmm. is 3 RAM, bold, and orange.
Okay.
And other places, you know, an H3 is 2.5 RAM, black, and italic.
Oh, and you want the H2 look.
But yeah, on one page, the outline is not nested to that level, or the artifact, like if it's a, you know, a card embed of some kind, like an mm-hmm. article card or something, the designer may want the look of the H2 on this element, even though from a DOM standpoint, it should be an H3.
Got it.
So it's about pattern application at that point. So that's why, at least for us, that's why we have that available to us.
That's cool. It works and it solves the problem. So it's fine.
Yeah, it's very simple.
I just the first time I saw it though, I was like, what? Like, I mean, I think the reason I'm questioning it is, like, why would you call it H1 through H6 when you could use a more meaningful name, like very large and very small and, like, gradations in between, like something that actually makes sense to a human reading it, versus using something that is just replicating like HTML.
Yeah. For us, we don't expect a lay user to need to know that. Like, that's sure. us doing it in design, so to speak.
Right.
So that's why, again, for us, it works out fine, because it's just an application of a pattern in template files.
Yeah. Yeah. So I see the next one is P versus double break.
Yeah.
VR. I've seen that one before.
Yeah. This is another one. And I think it's, I think it comes a little bit
from... I've done that one before, actually.
It comes from copy and paste, I think, a lot.
Mm.
Okay. I don't know. I may be wrong on that, but I feel like that's where I see it a lot, is in content that feels like it was copied out of Notepad, for instance,
and then pasted in.
Put into a WYSIWYG editor without thought and, you know, oversight.
Do you think that's because the WYSIWYG editor is interpreting a carriage return line feed as a line break?
I mean, sure. It has to be. Normally, I don't think a lot of people intentionally write HTML that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know it has happened. Like, it's something that exists out in the wild. And even if it's happening because you're copying and pasting, it means you're not paying attention to what you're pasting. Where that gets scary is if you are copying and pasting a lot of stuff out of, for instance, Google Docs.
Mm.
We used to say this a lot. Can remember how notorious it used to be copying content out of Word?
God. Oh, geez, Michael, I hadn't thought about that in years.
The nightmares, the anxiety that would cause a web developer, because...
All right. We have to explain this.
Go for it.
I don't think... All right. So there was the O tag, right? It was like O:, MSXML or something.
And there was like a class that was like MSO-something.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and then every font styling would be done using a font tag, right?
And like every piece of text, regardless of if it was formatted or not, was wrapped in multiple elements in most cases.
Oh my God. It was so bad that WYSIWYG editors, Tiny MCE, I know, had this. I forget if FCK editor had it or not. They would have a paste from Word option.
Yeah.
Which would clean up all of the shit that comes in with Word formatting.
It basically just stripped everything out.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's what it makes me think of, though. And Google Docs is now sort of that. I have that problem a lot because we have, of course, content editors now that send us content to put on the site. Mm-hmm. And anytime I go to copy it out of their Google Docs, because that's what our people use, inevitably I get a P tag with a font weight equals something, and then a span tag, and I have to go through and take all that crap out every single time because I don't want it. It's like it's making the text bold and then manually restyling it to be normal. I don't even know why that's a thing.
It was the late 90s, and I was just doing my personal website. I didn't think CSS existed yet, but I know that the margins on a P tag were too big. And I just wanted to have like a small line break in between a paragraph. And I remember using a double line break for that.
Yeah. Yeah, because a line break is line height as opposed to a P tag, which its margin could be whatever is defined.
Yeah, it varies. Yeah. I think if you're concerned about vertical spacing, the solution to that is to fix your P margins better.
Define it right for the space you're using it, the context you're using it in.
Yeah.
So the next one that I've got is a simple one. Hold on.
Yeah.
Oh, there's that sound. buttons versus classing buttons.
Yeah, so this is, I see this a lot in like templating CSS frameworks like Bootstrap.
Yeah.
They'll have like a button class, and then you'll simulate buttons that are actually links.
And like this again is more of an accessibility thing than anything else.
Buttons are tricky because you have input type equals button, and then you have button itself, and then you have links that can be made to resemble buttons by styling them with CSS.
Input type, so let's go through these, right? Yeah. So if you are using input type equals button, this one's easy because it should only be used in a form.
Is it type equals button or type equals submit?
Well, both. You can submit means it's a submit button, like it's going to trigger the form behavior. Mm. But you can have an input type equals button.
Which would be for like JavaScript stuff.
Which would be, you'd have to attach something to it, obviously.
Right.
But it's it is meant to be inside a form element and nowhere else. Right. You should never use that anywhere else on your page. On a normal button element, like literally button tag, the button tag has sort of the intrinsic quality of being something that is an interaction. It should do something on the page. If you if you click it, it should increment something. If you click it, it should pop something up. If you click it, it should do something interactive.
It should have a function.
It should have a function on the page. Usually where you have an A tag that is just classed button is when you just have a link that has to go somewhere and you're trying to create a repetitive UI element that looks nice. And so the classic example of this is the read more button, you know, or get more information or apply now. Like we make buttons that are what we call CTAs, calls to action. Those are fine. But what happens is people start to use one or the other always as opposed to use them contextually correct. Yeah, it's all semantics. An A tag should always go somewhere.
It's funny when you see a button that has class button.
Yeah, I've seen that.
I understand why sometimes you have to do that. But whenever I see that, I'm like, why don't you just style the button element?
Yeah.
And then do a sass mix-in of the styles.
Yeah. I do always make sure that that is in my CSS.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think that's that makes sense. If you want to have like a link that functions as a link and looks like a button, okay. But like it should be clear that it's like what the function is.
Yeah. And it should go somewhere. You should never have, because where this gets a little gnarly is when you start seeing A tags that have an href of a hash.
Right. And it's just wired up to JavaScript.
And it's, yeah.
Yes, that's what I saw on that benefits site.
Right. They hijack the behavior and then make it do something.
Yes. They did JavaScript void for the href. And then it was like on, it was on click. Then that would handle the link thing. And I'm like, why? Why would you do this?
And what a lot of people, I think, don't realize is what does A stand for? A has a semantic meaning.
Anchor, right?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I thought it was.
It goes somewhere. It anchors your behavior to a location. And so the whole point is, if you don't have an href on it that goes to a URL of some kind or to another point on the page, then you should be using the button tag.
Yeah.
That's
I will say, in the HTML 1.0 spec, I think most of the tags were very, very short. So it was like A tag for links.
Oh, God, yeah.
B for bold. I for italics.
I.
O for... No, no. U for underline.
Oh, God, yeah, U.
Remember that one? Okay, haven't used that in memories. A long time.
I have a picture of me and a little baby U just sitting on the shore of the beach looking out before it grew up.
Yeah, but like there was a lot of single letter tags because you had to type them by hand, and because you know space was a commodity then.
A versus anchor saves you 4 bytes.
Yeah, I mean the funny thing though is that when I think it was when HTML3 came out and you had the link tag, which would be used for linking like a CSS document to the page. So you have a link tag, but then you have A tags, and so I feel bad for anyone who had to learn HTML. At that period would be like so I need to use a link tag to make a hyperlink, right? Well, no, you use an A tag.
That is a fair point. That is that's a usability issue with HTML, I will acknowledge. Yes. But yeah, so buttons versus anchors and classing them as buttons is just all about knowing when to use the right one. Buttons should be used for functional stuff on the page. Anchors should be used anytime you're going somewhere. And it's pretty simple and straightforward. Use the right one for the right place. One mistake I see a lot, and this is kind of a simple one, and there's not a lot to say about it, but it's just duplicating nav.
I think I know what you mean by that, but can you clarify?
Talking about like mobile devices. So you see this a lot with responsive design when people are first getting into responsive and they want to have a menu for their desktop and a menu for their phone. And instead of designing a responsive navigation, they show or hide a navigation based on a media query. This is problematic because you have two navs in the DOM.
Oh, gotcha.
And what we discussed, remember when we were talking about political websites, and one of the criticisms I brought up was when you were, if you were using keyboard navigation, if you were needing accessibility stuff, it can tab into a hidden navigation like that. So there's no reason to duplicate that. There's just no reason to do it. It's just a matter of learning better CSS and media queries to re-architect, realign, redo whatever it is you're trying to do with that main nav, whether that's make swipeable panels or subnavs or, you know, sub dropdowns, things like that. Like it's all that's possible. You just have to do the little bit extra work for your media queries.
Right. So the next one you have on the list is time.
Time.
And I know of the time tag.
K or
S. I'm not sure. So the time tag is for when you're multiplying content, right?
Donde está la biblioteca? I don't know why this is funny to me. Time. No, the reason I threw the time element in here is because I'm sure we covered this. We did an episode, I don't know, season two, about HTML elements that aren't used enough.
Oh, yeah. I remember that one.
And the time tag was included in that, and I'm including it again here because time is so relative, to borrow from a good friend of mine, Mr. Hawking. No, you don't have to worry about it.
Oh, Steve?
Time is something we deal with whether you are writing a blog or a news site or even, you know, posting products or things. You know, we have time displayed on our websites in so many places.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, time and time and time again, no pun intended, those things get wrapped in a div with a span, class equals month, all of this. There is a time element. You can wrap, again, this is about applying semantic meaning to stuff. And because we use time so much in development and in presentation, not using that element is just wasting semantic value for your page.
I think that this, and then the next item that we're going to talk about also, is underscoring this general concept that when you're writing HTML, the semantic meaning of the markup matters.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably maybe like kind of the take home. If you are new to the game, and by new, I really mean like 5 years or less. Like I'm including people 3 and 4 years in this. If you're new to the game, like this is something that's really important, is that the tags themselves have meaning. I don't care if you're writing React or Rails or PHP or whatever. Use the right HTML tags. And the more correct your HTML is, the more machine readable it is, the more accessible it is, and the more that you can do with it. It's an important thing.
I'll take it a step further because it's one thing to talk about, like, it's easy to learn how to write an anchor tag or to learn how to write an input tag and sort of the sterile, here is the way this tag is written. Semantics is all about how tags relate to other tags in your HTML.
Yeah.
And the meaning that that creates as sort of a vocabulary for the code. That's what semantics means to me anyway. And like when I talk to people about it, so that's why this becomes important, because time is sort of to borrow another phrase that we've latched onto, an idiom. It's an idiom of HTML. And so we are using a more robust and meaningful system of talking when we use these elements.
Yeah.
I think that's a fair way of putting that.
Sure.
My next one is similar in the sense of...
I was going to say, I think this is very similar. You have omitting the ABBR tag.
Yeah.
And ABBR is ironically short for abbreviation.
Yeah. Abbreviation.
I appreciate that.
Anytime, you know, and we go through this all the time, right? We try to say, you know, well, if I say HTML, let's stop for a second and make sure people know that's hypertext markup language. You know.
This is another place that semantics play in here. So when you take an acronym or an abbreviation and you wrap it in an ABBR tag, and you give it the property, which I want to say is title.
Yes.
And then you spell out the thing. Then that on its own doesn't demand any specific behavior, but the browsers have kind of a contract or compact, I would say, with the semantics of HTML, and they will say, well, if someone's going to use an ABBR tag with a title property, we're going to infer that what they mean is they want to convey, you know, this is the expanded version of the abbreviation, and we're going to present that in this way. And the browser designers or software engineers can decide what that means for their browser. When you choose to participate in the semantic meanings and behaviors of these tags, you're participating in this kind of, not relationship, but the agreement with the browser designers that by using your HTML correctly, they're going to present it correctly for you.
And again, SEO meaning, screen reader meaning, mm-hmm. And it's just helpful. It's just flat out helpful. The final one on here is, again, related to semantics, and the big semantics, like I mentioned, relationships between elements, not using labels on your fields, or at least not marking them up properly. I see that a lot, you know, when people make forms, they'll put inputs in there in text, and they'll just use P tags, line breaks, BRBR, to make the space in their form, but they aren't wrapping the text in a label tag for the element that it's related to. Again, helps for semantics, helps for screen readers, helps for interactivity, makes your hitbox bigger, especially for checkboxes. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of reasons why that's super valuable, but it's a really common mistake that people make.
I would say that whenever I've been at places that have gotten accessibility audits, either there may or may not have been lawsuits involved, including label tags on form fields has invariably been like every time that comes up.
Yeah.
So it's a really easy thing to add, and you get a lot of behaviors for free with how that works. Like the browser will pair things together better.
Yeah. Browsers will usually, even if you don't have a for attribute on a label, generally browsers will attach a label to the nearest sibling input by default. But obviously, like I say, having the for attribute helps significantly. Make sure that nothing gets screwed up, especially if it's after, like some people put stuff after a field instead, especially with checkboxes and radio buttons. So
there's
a lot of these. Adrian Legospi has an article, HTML underrated tags. I'll have linked in the show notes. Nice. A lot of these are in underrated that, and you can that's go back great. To our previous episode. I'll find what that was and maybe throw that in the show notes. Let's talk JavaScript.
Yeah.
My first is, don't rely on jQuery for everything.
Yeah.
Don't learn JavaScript through jQuery. And I may not have said that a few years ago.
Tell me to live my life, Michael.
I'm sorry?
So don't tell me how to live my life, Michael.
Yeah, that's fair. I say this as kind of a proxy for, you know, the people who used to sort of learn PHP by virtue of doing WordPress.
Oh,
but yeah, they didn't know they were learning PHP.
Right.
There's a lot to be said for sort of the training wheels that WordPress gives you or that jQuery gives you for these languages. But I think where we are as an industry with browser support and all of this, I agree with Chris Ferdinandi. Vanilla JS, learn that first. Learn that base stuff long before jQuery. Because the thing is now, jQuery is going to start to teach you bad habits. You're going to lean on it. And as a result, you're going to bloat your code. You're going to slow down your site because you could do it much quicker with native code.
His podcast, by the way, is great. The episodes are very short, and he talks about cool JavaScript things. He did one about performance, which I think we talked about that stuff on that episode with him.
Yeah.
But
the thing about it is that, you know, jQuery, yes, it's easy. Yes, it's fast. But at this point, you are shortchanging yourself in skills that will make you more valuable as you progress if you just learn to do stuff in vanilla JS. And in fact, what I'll do is, I don't have it here in the notes, but as I edit this, I'll make a note to myself. Well, I'll throw an article, a document rather, in the show notes from a user named Neffy. He's got a GitHub repo that shows you basically how to do all the common stuff in jQuery using vanilla.js.
Oh, right. I think you mentioned that.
Yeah, I think I'm sure I've brought it up or linked it in something else, but it's very useful. It's a great way, like if you're going to do a dot find, what's the quicker way to do it, or what's the better way to do a dot find? And yeah, check that out. The next thing was the one you had kind of mentioned that sort of started this whole thing, which is duplicating native functionality.
Yeah.
So this is like this idea of, you know, using JavaScript to fire off links.
God, I hate that.
There's no reason.
I really, really hate that.
Yeah. That goes to sort of, and I didn't have it in the notes, but it's a great point about JavaScript development in general, which is make sure you build in failure.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let it, like, and the classic, right, is X is undefined. You know, you're checking a variable that, for whatever reason, isn't set. And as a result, you've now stopped the execution of all of your JavaScript because your JavaScript file failed. You need to make sure you check. What if it's undefined? Then should we still run or should we console log it and move on? You have to handle errors. And not handling errors in JavaScript is a major, major issue that will slow you down and prevent your users from using your site.
So you have inefficient DOM manipulation.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
But what do you think I mean by that?
Think
about all the ways that we have to grab stuff from the DOM, right?
Oh, okay. Okay.
So like
if you have an inefficient selector query or something.
So yeah, this gets into the differences between things like query selector all, get element by class name, get element by ID. These are great utilities. You know, they basically take the place of the sort of dollar sign parentheses grab, you know, whatever class name you put into it for jQuery. These are the analogs for those in different contexts. But query selector all is incredibly greedy. And I mean, at scale, very, very inefficient because it is literally having to traverse your DOM every time it fires. Whereas get element by ID is much more efficient.
Yeah.
And again, it's one of those things where when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Once you've decided, well, query selector all, that works for everything I need. I'll just use it on all of them.
Right.
That's
a good one.
It makes a lot of sense. If you can ID something in your code and use get element by ID, it's going to make your JavaScript faster and your page more efficient. Even if it's small already, it's still, you know, again, this is one of those things where learn to do it right, because 5 years from now, you may be working on a site where that will matter. And those differences could be what gets you a job or doesn't get you a job. So, and I'm going to throw back to JavaScript and markup and buttons. Yeah. I'm going to tie all those together because you said something that reminded me. One of the other things I've seen that people do with JavaScript and bad markup is create like clickable span tags. Have you seen these?
Oh, God.
We looked at a library site back quite a few episodes back, and one of those had like panels. They had the widgets on the page and everything was clickable, but it was all span tags. So don't do that either. Okay. So CSS. Some of these come from an article over at painlesscss.com, the top 10 CSS mistakes. I think I threw one or two of these in from my own. Mm-hmm. First of all, same thing. Using overly specific selectors. And so this gets into classes and IDs. So I like this sort of piggybacking this discussion. Mm-hmm. Have you ever looked at like the sort of equation that gets used for CSS specificity?
We talked about this in a previous episode.
Yeah.
I don't remember if it was the one with Dustin Shaw or not, but it was a previous episode. I remember talking about CSS specificity.
Yeah. I don't remember where we talked about it, but basically there is an equation. It's not an equation, is maybe not the best term, a convention.
Like an inequality.
That kind of, there's like a 4-digit number that gets computed based on, the specificity. IDs, classes, elements, and inline, and trying to determine what overrules what. So when you've got these strings of selectors, how do you know which one should apply over another? Or if you've got selectors that use different class names but ultimately target the same stuff, which rules apply over another? One of the ways this breaks for people is that, I'm going to say straight out, there are different schools of thought on this. I am one that says, don't use IDs in CSS. There are reasons to. There are certainly, you know, everybody's code is different. Everybody's, you know, needs are different. So you may be in a situation where it makes sense.
Are we talking about performance reasons?
Mostly performance reasons, yes.
Okay.
It's mostly about the fact that an ID is top tier specific, aside from a style tag. And that quality makes it very hard to override as a consequence of it. And so if you're using IDs, you're setting yourself up in a position where, you know, if you need to change the way something looks on one page versus another, you can't do that. You can't apply an ID multiple times on the page. So if you've got a reusable style, you can't reuse it if you've used an ID tag. So IDs generally should be avoided. The one area where I like it is using IDs to kind of namespace a set of styles. That makes sense to me. If you need to isolate something kind of away from it, using an ID as sort of the parent selector can help lock that down. And like I say, every use case will be a little different, but by using classes, you can create these nice reusable chunks that don't have to be super specific.
The way that we used to do it, and I know it doesn't get done this much anymore because of CSS frameworks, but you would have the ID tag would basically define the different sections of the page. So you'd have an ID for like the nav area. You'd have an ID for the body, like the content area or main sometimes. You'd have an ID for the header, ID for the footer. And that would kind of be it usually, unless it was a really like an important reason, like add space number 2 or something. But that would be it for IDs. And then everything else would be classes underneath it. So your nav items would be class nav item, and your articles would be class article. This is before the article tag existed, but the IDs would only be a few of them on a page. Most of the styles you would use after that would be classes, or you would do like Michael was saying, you would use it. You start with the ID and then you would do a CSS hierarchy. You know, so content and then P and then A, and then you would say like, well, what does a link tag look when it's in the content paragraphs?
From a performance standpoint, the longer you make the selectors, the more dense they are, and the longer they take to process as a consequence. If you know...
But chances are your page is probably not complicated enough for that performance to matter.
Yeah, probably not. Yeah. At least at first. Like I say, you end up at a big company and get into some gnarly SAS files using, for instance, direct descendant attributes and stuff in your selectors starts to make a big difference, because that helps narrow down the specificity so that it can, it's not traversing a whole ancestor tree. There's an article.
I was just going to say that. Oh, so there's an art to doing it.
Oh, there's an article over at slicejack.com that gets into specificity and how it's calculated. I'll throw that in the show notes in case anybody wants to dig in, because I think it is really important if you're writing CSS to understand how the selectors you write affect specificity. I think that matters a ton, actually.
What do you have? It says PX.
PX.
What do you mean for that?
Pixels.
Like padding? Oh, okay.
Over reliance on using pixels as your measurement scheme, because pixels don't scale. Pixels are fine to define like your base font size, but beyond the page's base font size, you should be using rems and m's for everything for the most part.
Right, and so m's the
are
width of an m character, and then rems are the width of an m character at the root level,
right?
Like a root m.
So it basically comes down to is the size relative to my parent or relative to my root? I use rems for almost everything. There are rare occasions where you will want something relevant to a parent, especially if you're dealing with image sizing or something like that.
Mm.
Most of the time, okay. I like REMS just because I know my base font size is 16, so I know, you know, all my math can factor off that. Why that matters is when you start zooming pages. Being able to scale pages right. and have them scale seamlessly and beautifully correctly. in terms of getting bigger and smaller, REMS are what yeah. make that possible.
Right. Okay. So we have building media queries from large to small.
Mobile first. Still a mobile first world.
Let's go into that in more. Like for media queries, we're talking about in your SAS, or I guess you could do it in regular
CSS. It's
too,
normal CSS, but yeah, SAS lets you do certainly crazier stuff. The idea being
so you define like min width, max width.
Right. Build for your smallest width first, not your biggest width. Mm-hmm. We tend to build for desktop because we're on a desktop when we're writing all this. The reality is, taking a desktop layout and writing code to conditionally change it as it gets smaller is significantly harder than writing something linear for a small screen and then writing CSS to change it as it gets wider.
That's a good point. I don't do this enough, I think.
Yeah. It's a hard lesson to learn, and it's I don't know if it's unintuitive, but I know that it's definitely something that until you've done it and really thought about the way responsive stuff works, it doesn't make a lot of sense until you see that in action. But the whole thing comes down to, you know, a mobile device tends to be very linear. It's very 1, 2, 3, 4 in a column. At most, you may have something side by side, but on a phone, you're so limited on horizontal width that you're not going to have a lot of stuff. Taking something that isn't linear to begin with and forcing it to be linear is much harder than taking something linear and then moving it around as you want to. This is where, and we haven't done an episode on it, but one is coming on like CSS grids. CSS grids are a revelation in terms of responsive design and figuring out like how to take something linear and make it, you know, all gridded out and moved around and look nice on a widescreen.
Hmm.
But that it's just this idea that you're going to save time and it's going to make your site better by building small to large than large to small.
I like that. And the last one I have is web fonts. And I know what web fonts are, but I'm not sure what their point is here.
I should have put more notes, right? Web fonts is all about size. It's just about the amount of data we're packing into requests. People like web fonts because it's an easy way to make a site look pretty.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also an easy way to make a site huge.
Got it.
You know, like web fonts, especially if you start getting into variable fonts, those files are enormous and you are really you're going to very quickly make your site wildly out of control in terms of the payload size.
So that's actually a really good point. I think, let's say you're using a web font, like you found a really cool font and you want to use it for like the header of your image or something, like the header of your site. It would be better to rasterize that as an image and then do an alt tag or a title tag on it rather than load it as a web font if that's the only place you're using it, because the image will probably be smaller. And if you're going to use a web font, resist the urge to use like a really fancy or wild looking font, especially if it's for your body copy.
Or resist the urge to use every variation of it.
Yeah. The point of a website is to communicate words and communicate ideas. So don't create hurdles for your users. Font is important, and I'm not trying to say that like we should all use Times New Roman or Arial or whatever. But unless you have a really good reason, like go with a basic font. I mean, if you can just use a plain sans serif font or use one that is on most systems or just provide like a, you know, the fail sequence with like Arial then sans serif. So like the font family property is really good for that. And if the font's available, that's great. And if it's not, then it should display okay otherwise.
The last area I have is media before I've got the sort of generic one coming up after this. But the only thing I have to say about media is optimize your imagery. Don't take a photo on your DSLR and upload it straight to your website or even on your phone these days. Optimize your imagery for either the width that it's going to be or the display depth that needs to be. You don't need 8 meg images on your site. That's a big one.
Go check episode 45.
Yes.
It was images, formats, and optimization.
I beat you to it this time. I had actually looked up which episode number it was because I'm tired of always getting one-upped on that. Just make sure. And we have a whole episode that gets into how to optimize your imagery and why. And it's just a thing where it's so easy for somebody to take a picture and just throw it on a website and not think about the fact that, oh, that image is huge, especially if you're on a fast connection. So be considerate of those users who maybe have limited bandwidth. The last area is just accessibility, generic accessibility. A lot of what we have said applies to accessibility, but there are a few very basic ones. The first is the obvious, which is not taking time to put in alt attributes because you're lazy. Stop being lazy and write your damn alt attributes. There's no reason not to. It takes you a few seconds. I admit I'm bad about it on Twitter. Now that they support doing it, I'll upload images and not write a description. I should, and I'm lazy, and that is not good on me, and that is not good on you if you're not doing it. So, alt attributes. It is okay to leave an alt attribute blank if the image is purely decorative. It helps if you put role equals presentation on that image. And then that way a screen reader knows specifically that that image is not meant to convey information. So, alt attributes.
That's cool.
Type them in. Do it. Tiny hitboxes. So this is one that's going to come up in WCAG 2.2. You have a minimum hitbox size in WCAG 2.2. It's 44 pixels. At least it was in the last release candidate that had come out. It may have changed since then, but 44 pixels was the minimum. Stop making stuff small. And where I see this as a problem is when people use icons for things like, you know, your profile, you go into your profile and you have an edit icon and stuff like that. And they put that little cog up there, but the cog is like a 16 pixel cog. Right. 44 pixels. That's going to be the minimum standard for accessibility compliance. And it just makes it easier for your users. Why are you making me be precise with my mouse on a 2K or 4K monitor? Give me some room.
You don't need that level of density.
Give me some room. And then the other one is just making choices that fail. So this one is a little more abstract, and it's one that you have to take the time to learn some accessibility stuff. And I know it's so easy to just jump in and start writing code and start building a website, but you need to take the time to learn things. Color contrast is a big one. Learning not to put certain colors on top of each other. You know, white on yellow or yellow on white is a common one, or white on orange, you know, for alert stuff. Doesn't work. You have to use a dark orange, like a burnt umber type color, because you don't pass color contrast standard. And you have to care about that to do it, because the browser will let you do it. The browser will let you write that code. It's you who have to stop yourself from doing it.
If you have, I've actually been dealing with this in the past couple of weeks. If you have text displaying over an image that may or may not be light or dark, like you have kind of like a template and the image is going to be varied depending on how the template renders, you can use text shadow.
Yeah.
So use text shadow, like 2px, 2px black, and it will give your text a nice black outline that will always give you contrast on the text, regardless of what the background color is.
The other one is stuff like, people will frequently do things like, well, I don't like underlines under my text. And so CSS will let you remove that so that you're...
Are you talking about links?
Yeah, so links won't be underlined.
Yeah.
Links need to be underlined. You can't convey meaning through just color. And if the only way people know something is a link is because it's blue, that's not good enough.
Right.
That is not accessible at that point.
The contrast between black and link blue color is not very much.
No, not at all. Yeah. Especially if you are full colorblind or I'd have to run it through. I think one of the other ones, you don't have to be full colorblind One of the other ones, blue turns black, basically. It's a design decision, and it's one you can make in a vacuum. If you don't know things about accessibility, you don't like underlines, so you just take them out. And you don't consider the fact that people need underlines to identify what's clickable on your page in some cases.
I think the gold standard is using the standard blue link text that your browser gives you and the underline that your browser gives you, and that's what you use for links. And then if you have to do different than that because reasons, have a good reason for it.
So I hope this helps you out. I hope it gives you some insight into the things you can try to avoid from a pitfall standpoint, and things you can sort of adapt to and change and tweak, make sure your stuff is better. The big thing is always be looking towards what makes your code better, what makes it faster, more efficient, and more just right. Don't assume that just because you learned something one way that that's the only way. Question, you know, sit down and say, why is this, you know, why is this the HTML I use for this? Or why was this the one that, you know, why is this if statement the way it was written for this JavaScript function I'm using? Question stuff and try to figure out, is there a better way to do it? Because that's how you consistently get better. Stick with us. We're going to take a break real fast and we'll be right back. The Drunken UX Podcast is brought to you by our friends at NewCloud. NewCloud is an industry-leading interactive map provider who has been building location-based solutions for organizations for a decade. Are you trying to find a simple solution to provide your users with an interactive map of your school, city, or business? Well, NewCloud's interactive map platform gives you the power to make and edit a custom interactive map in just minutes. They have a team of professional cartographers who specialize in map illustrations of many different styles and are ready to design an artistic rendering to fit your exact needs. One map serves all of your users' devices with responsive maps that are designed to scale and blend in seamlessly with your existing website. To request a demonstration or to view their portfolio, visit them online at nucloud.com/drunkenux. That's nucloud.com/drunkenux. I hope everybody enjoyed tonight's show. Stick with us. We got about 3 more shows left for the season, and then we're out of your hair. But actually, we won't be, because we'll be right back in January. But we're going to take a break probably somewhere in there. It'll be imaginary to you guys. If you want to contact us, though, don't be afraid to reach out. We are on Twitter or Facebook at /DrunkenUX. On Instagram, you can hit us up at /DrunkenUXPodcast. And you can always chat with us at DrunkenUX.com/Discord. And that will get you into our friendly neighborhood Discord server. Aaron, I appreciate you joining me this evening and spending time out of your night. I know it's been busy for you and that you're a guy.
Citation needed.
Well, the beard's kind of a giveaway. At least in my experience. Folks, stick with us. We got a lot coming up for the rest of the season. We got some exciting stuff queued up for next season. We've also got a couple more surprises left for 2020, I think, that it's of interest to us. I'm always kind of trying to stack up a few things here. All I care about is, at the end of the day, just keep your personas close and your users closer. No jokes this week.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye.